All right, do me a favor and go like this. Say big banks while at the same time slowly and ruefully shaking your head back and forth. From American Public Media, this is Market Plans. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is the 20th of May today, Wednesday. Great, as always, to have you with us, everybody. You know, sometimes the news lines up for you just about perfectly, and this happens to be one of those times. We told you yesterday about ethics on Wall Street and how the finance industry can sometimes be challenged in that regard. And then, lo and behold, we wake up this morning to this. Five big banks are going to pay more than $5.5 billion all told to settle charges they manipulated foreign exchange markets and a key global interest rate known as LIBOR. Now, let me just say here, I know, I hear you. A story about some interest rate over in London and the foreign exchange markets thrown in there to boot. Come on, make me care. Well, Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer is going to do just that.
When we talk about LIBOR and currency manipulation, I know your eyes glaze over. But listen up, because surprise, surprise, when banks do all this manipulating and skewing, guess who loses out? You.
It's a big problem for the economy.
That's Simon Johnson. He teaches economics at MIT's Sloan School of Management. He says the LIBOR rate, officially known as the London Interbank Offered Rate, is what big banks charge each other for loans. And lots of consumer loans with variable interest rates are based on it.
There are important amounts of borrowing for car loans and for credit cards that are absolutely tied to a variable rate, and that variable rate is often LIBOR.
Adjustable rate mortgages are also tied to the LIBOR, according to Guy Sakala, publisher of Inside Mortgage Finance. He says the LIBOR manipulation has made consumers suspicious.
It undermined the whole credibility of a index for a mortgage that supposedly was above board in terms of how it adjusted and either lowered or raised your payment.
You consumers were also affected by the currency manipulation, although more indirectly. Hillary Sale teaches law and management at Washington University in St. Louis. She says U.S. companies with business abroad might have lost out because of this skewed currency market.
And when that happens, they have to pass on the cost somewhere, and they may well pass them on to consumers.
So the next time you yawn at someone manipulating a market far away that you've never heard of, just remember, you could be the one who pays. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Speaking of tinkering with exchange rates as we just were, Congress is debating whether or not to attach some new rules about what countries can and cannot do with their currencies to the fast-track trade legislation that's in the works in the Senate right now. The Obama administration is really, really opposed to adding those rules, even as it's really, really for getting on with the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TPP, the underlying trade bill itself. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson explains this slice of the currency story.
Trade deals are big, complex agreements that try and get everyone playing from the same rulebook. Jared Bernstein is with the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities and a former member of President Obama's economic team.
What I think we're trying to do here is to create a playing field on which international trade will take place now for years to come. So you want labor standards, you want environmental standards, and you also want currency standards.
If a country devalues its currency to make it cheaper relative to other countries, well, then its exports get cheaper, too. And Bernstein says that means the field isn't level anymore. But Treasury Secretary Jack Lew said yesterday that adding these currency rules could open the door for other countries to challenge Federal Reserve policies. Ishwar Prasad is a professor at Cornell.
It's a pretty fine line between actual intervention in the foreign exchange market and alternatively using monetary policy, that is printing more money or reducing interest rates in order to make the currency cheaper in value.
So while Jared Bernstein thinks spotting currency manipulators is very straightforward, Alan Sykes, a professor at NYU Law School, says countries always have other explanations.
They're promoting development, they're maintaining a stable value of their currency, or in the case of the United States, we need low interest rates to stimulate the economy in the face of a serious recession. So there's always a story.
The Senate is expected to vote on a trade bill later this week. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
So after all of that macroeconomics, Wall Street today, Bupkis. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. A lot of the national media focus has moved away from the story of Baltimore and Freddie Gray. But his death due to injuries sustained in police custody last month started, or actually restarted, a whole lot of conversations. Conversations about the role of police in society, about race and opportunity, and in Baltimore specifically, about jobs, the lack of jobs, and economic investment in particular parts of that city. Sandtown Winchester, the area where Freddie Gray grew up, has an unemployment rate of 22% today. But 20 years ago, under the Clinton administration, Baltimore got $100 million that city leaders said they would use to create jobs in places like Sandtown. So Noel King from our Wealth and Poverty Desk went to Baltimore and started asking around, looking for an answer to this question. How many jobs did $100 million get?
Well, Kai, everyone in Baltimore said there's one person who would know the answer.
Hi, I'm here to see Diane Bell McCoy, please.
What is your name?
My name is Noelle King.
Oh, hello.
Diane Bell McCoy chaired the Empower Baltimore Management Corporation, the nonprofit that oversaw the federal dollars. The money was part of a Clinton administration plan to tackle inner-city poverty, and the plan started with a contest. Six cities would win $100 million each, plus tax breaks for business and employers. The money would be spent in the poorest neighborhoods, and those areas would be called empowerment zones. Here's Diane Bell McCoy.
I remember it was a galvanizing force in terms of all the kind of rah-rah that happens with putting the application together and bringing all the different sectors together.
She's not kidding about the rah-rah. 74 cities applied, but Baltimore sent a caravan of school buses packed with people and a marching band to D.C. to deliver the city's application. It paid off. In December 94, Andrew Cuomo, then an assistant secretary with the Department of Housing and Urban Development, announced the winners.
In particular order, New York City, Chicago, Atlanta, Detroit, Baltimore.
Cities had some leeway on how they spent the money. Chicago spent a lot on social services, Atlanta on housing for low-income people. But in Baltimore,
this must be about jobs. This must be about creating jobs. That was a mantra. There was this expectation, there was this vision in people's heads. $100 million creating jobs will then change, transform neighborhoods.
So the money was dispersed with jobs in mind. Here's a breakdown of the biggest allotments. About $35 million went to workforce development, career centers, job training. $27 million went to job creation, like small business loans. Not all the money went to jobs. $13 million went to quality of life, like cleaning up lead paint and financing home improvements. The Federal Empowerment Zone program lasted 10 years. Baltimore kept detailed records of how the money was spent. When it was over in 2004, Bell McCoy asked University of Baltimore researchers to count the number of jobs that had been created, which is why she can answer the big question.
How many jobs did $100 million get you?
You know what? I brought for you an actual account of that.
Can I get you to read for me the part where it says,
From 1994 to 2004, it was estimated that there were 5,777 direct jobs created within the EZ that are directly tied to the job creation programs.
5,777.
Mm-hmm.
And remember, this was just in the poorest neighborhoods, which had a total population of about 54,000 people. 10 years later, had it worked, what do those neighborhoods look like? I started making calls to businesses who'd received tax credits or small business loans. I found some names in old housing and urban development reports, examples at the time of the program's success, like globe screen printers.
The number you dialed is not in service.
And Charm City, a sign maker.
Hello. We can help you find another business in the area since the number you called is not in service.
And Meadow, which manufactured air fresheners.
The number you dialed is not in service.
So those businesses are closed. But Baltimore also invested some of the Empowerment Zone money in infrastructure for companies that employed hundreds of people in poor areas. I went to one. I'm in the Fairfield area of Baltimore, which is this sprawling peninsula of industrial companies, petrochemical companies, shipping companies. And I'm outside of the FMC company during the time of Baltimore's empowerment zones. This company was said to be creating or retaining about 187 jobs. In the meantime, though, all I see is a big concrete building that's empty, a parking lot that's empty, and signs saying, no trespassing, keep out. There was a truck driver idling outside in a tanker. I asked if he knew what happened to FMC, a company that makes ingredients for insecticides and herbicides.
You know what? It looked like they closed.
How long have you been working down here?
It's been years.
And you haven't seen anyone?
Nope, and if you look at the parking lot, there's nothing there. I think they closed.
He was right. FMC closed its Baltimore plant 7 years ago. 150 people were laid off. A spokesman told me via email it was, quote, part of our move to achieve more competitive costs. Today, the products that used to be manufactured in Baltimore are made in China, India, and Mexico. There were some local job creation success stories. In 1997, Sylvan Learning Systems moved its headquarters to Baltimore's Harbor East neighborhood. That's now a vibrant area of shops and restaurants, even a Whole Foods. Also, thousands of people got job training. Most analysts say Baltimore spent the money well. But then the federal funds ended and the economy changed. Douglas Austin is the president of UPD Consulting. 20 years ago, he was a subcontractor to PricewaterhouseCoopers, which provided support to the empowerment zone cities.
Businesses start and close doors every day. We don't say that capitalism is a failure because a restaurant that opened 5 years ago is no longer here and that the 10 people that worked at that restaurant are no longer employed by that restaurant. You know, they probably gained skills that they took on into their next job, and I am absolutely certain that some of them became entrepreneurs themselves.
But this doesn't change Diane Bell McCoy's view. What bothers her is that the poorest neighborhoods are still the poorest neighborhoods.
I can tell you factually, by looking at wage record data, that people benefited. I can tell you factually that people that got loan for us for home ownership, that they still own their homes. I can tell you factually that there are some businesses that survive. I can tell you all that factually. But I can tell you that wasn't enough.
It wasn't enough for Sandtown Winchester. It's hard to find a single example of a business that started there during the empowerment zone decade. The unemployment rate has only ticked up. We analyzed census data in the six tracts that make up the neighborhood. During the time of the empowerment zones, unemployment was at 18%. 2 years ago, the most recent census data available, unemployment was at 22%. That data includes the Great Recession years. Given all of that, how do you tell the story of job creation in a place like Sandtown? Antoine Bennett has an idea. He's an outreach minister at New Song Community Church in Sandtown. In the mid-90s, right as the empowerment zone money was coming in, he'd just come home after a 3.5-year stint in prison on an attempted murder charge.
Before I left, you know, none of this was happening, none of this community development on this level. So when I came home and I heard that there are employment opportunities taking place, or at least centers to point you in the direction of employment.
He took advantage of the employment centers, worked with a youth group, then later got hired at the church.
To go through that process of being treated like a human being, after spending 3.5 years of being treated as a number, literally having people call you 205-109, which is my actual prison ID number, to being treated like Mr. Bennett. And I have not been unemployed since I've been a part of this community development effort. I have not missed a paycheck.
Bennett says the empowerment zones transformed him.
Our goal is to build up strong men of character in this community that the world can look and say, in that community, it is easy for them to go from ex-cons to icon in a very unique way. In that community, it's certainly this evidence that the ill-fated are truly illuminated in that community.
$100 million, 5,777 jobs, some of them gone. But at least one guy got a job and kept a job. And now, he says, neighborhood transformation is his job. In Baltimore, I'm Noelle King for Marketplace.
Coming up, You know, I had studied reality TV. I had studied this show. Why not see if I could translate some of that knowledge into actually playing the game? Easier said than done, yo. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's off 26 points today at 10%, 18,285 for the blue chips. The NASDAQ up a point, less than a 10%, 5,071. The S&P 500 off a point, less than a 10%, 2,125. There was a mini rally of sorts after minutes from the Federal Reserve's latest policy meeting came out. Those minutes do make it seem like a June interest rate hike is unlikely. Yaha. The rally, however, was short-lived or short-lived. Take your pick. Southwest Airlines said revenue per passenger will go down this quarter, and traders took it from there. Southwest off 9%, American Airlines and United off 10%, Delta off 5%. Bonds up, the yield on the 10-year T-note down to 2.26%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. The National Association of Realtors will release numbers of existing home sales for the month of April. The Labor Department will report weekly jobless claims. And on this day in 1901, Connecticut became the first state to pass a law regulating motor vehicles. It set a speed limit of a whopping 12 miles per hour in the city. You might as well jog. I'm Daisy Palacios.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Two words, people, two little words. Advertising and technology. Oh, and maybe mobile should be in there as well, I guess. That'd make it three. That is the name of the game at a conference in San Francisco this week, cleverly called Ad Tech. Thousands of advertising and marketing types are there trying to divine the secrets of making digital advertising pay off. And the stakes are high here, too. Ad technology has been behind a whole bunch of acquisitions over the past couple of years, including just the other day, Verizon spending $4.5 billion for AOL, if you remember that. Our senior tech correspondent, Molly Wood, explains what's going on here.
Advertising used to look like this. People went out to lunch, drank a lot, had some great ideas, and put them on television.
I like to teach the world to sing. Sing with me.
But now, advertising is all about the machines. And targeting an ad to the whole world is not happening anymore. Doug Fleming heads up programmatic ad sales at Hulu, the online TV streaming service. He's giving a talk at Ad Tech this week about the way things are working now. He gave me a preview.
It is absolutely imperative that a publisher has their technology stack in order. Their content management system is speaking to their database that they're...
What? Well, here's what. Digital advertising is on a tear. It's expected to hit $50 billion this year, and a lot of that is thanks to automation. Buying, selling, and placing ads is all done by computers. Like this. I load up a YouTube video on my phone.
You read the labels on the foods you eat, but do you know what's in your skincare?
Neutrogena Naturals.
There's a tiny pause before the ad plays. And during that pause...
In 9/1000th of a second, there's a mini bidding war that takes place to see who's going to win that impression.
That's Kenny Day. He runs political ad sales for Yahoo. The process he's describing is something called real-time bidding.
That's really the drive. That's the engine.
Real-time bidding isn't new. Google introduced the idea in 2009 when it bought the ad tech company DoubleClick and basically invented computerized ad auctions. But ad tech really took off when the power of buying and selling in a fraction of a second was combined with mounds of data about consumers.
There are all these data companies that are dropping pixels on you. They're cookieing you. They know that you are a female between the ages of 30 and 54, and that you live in Orange County, and that you lean slightly right.
And when you log into Facebook or Google or surf on your phone, those little trackers follow you everywhere.
Everyone's sort of tagged with these IDs, and we all carry this identity around with us. It's called your long tail.
The data is anonymous, but the computers compare your activities to millions of people who are doing the same things as you online. And then they try to figure out what kinds of ads people like you are going to like. And the more data they have, the better their targeting and the bigger the payoff for advertisers. So when someone like me loads up a video online, this is what I get.
Neutrogena Naturals, a line of nutrient-rich skincare.
And that, dear listeners, is the cross-device, behaviorally targeted, real-time bidding technology stack in action. See? Makes perfect sense. In San Francisco, I'm Molly Wood for Marketplace.
Whether it's the soon-to-be-departed American Idol or The Bachelor or Survivor, whose season finale is tonight, millions of people watch reality TV in this country. Just a relative handful play, of course. Max Dawson was on this season's Survivor, an opportunity he got in part because he used to teach a course at Northwestern University called The Tribe Has Spoken, Surviving TV's New Reality. I asked him how it all happened.
I started teaching the class in January 2012, and I got a call about a month into the class from someone saying, would you like to be on the show? When the idea was planted in my head, it suddenly seemed really logical. You know, I had studied reality TV. I had studied this show. Why not see if I could translate some of that knowledge into actually playing the game?
Okay, so here comes the indelicate question. If you were so well prepared, how come you're so voted off already?
I was voted off in the second week.
Yep.
And when I found myself out there, I came to the harsh realization that not everyone loves a know-it-all, that sometimes, you know, you have to learn to be able to ingratiate yourself into groups of people who you might not otherwise be friends with.
So the theme this year, this season, I guess, was white collar, blue collar, no collar. How do you think that affected how things went for you?
Well, given the general animosity that exists in our culture toward white collar people these days, white collar is synonymous with the 1%, the oppressor, the man. And Jeff Probst, on the first day when he told us what our tribe designations were, I bristled at it. Because to me, that was putting a target on our backs. You know, the blue collars were described as the hardworking, authentic Americans, the no collars as these, you know, delightful free spirits. And then there was the evil empire, the white collars. And I think that it was certainly something that we had to work against. It didn't help my game, I'll tell you that.
So Survivor, this is the 30th season of this show in the past 15 years. It came online with American Idol and some others that are now fading away. How much longer do you think Survivor sticks around?
Well, it hasn't had the sustained popularity that Idol has, but Survivor has maintained a steady core audience of around 10 million viewers. It's really mainly a question, I think, of how long Jeff Probst is interested in going off to these far-flung locations and putting 18 reality TV lunatics through the paces of these challenges.
Well, so give me the thinking man's answer then to this next question, which is the role and the place of reality television in society today. I mean, you're a consultant for reality TV, you're a survivor, ba-doom boom, of reality television. Where does it place? What does it say about us that this is how we get our entertainment now?
Well, a lot of times people talk about a show like Survivor as being an X-ray, that we see the true, authentic nature of these contestants. I think that it also holds true for the audience. This current season, for example, had a number of instances of bullying that provoked conversations that also brought out a lot of ugliness in the audience. I see it as this great sociological experiment that not only allows us to be entertained, but forces us to confront things that we might not otherwise want to confront or that our entertainment might otherwise allow us to avoid.
Max Dawson, Survivor once and perhaps future. Max, thanks very much.
Thanks, Kai.
We've all pretty much by definition had a first job. Waiting tables, retail maybe, or like today's installment of our series, First Jobs, temping from a time that seems like it was a long while ago.
My name is Melissa O'Neill, and my first job was at a front desk receptionist at a dating site. Back in the day before the internet, they would actually take videos of people doing all the things they do in the online forums now. A person sitting in a room talking about what they're looking for in someone and who they're interested in dating. I was a member of a temp agency, so I found out about the job just as one of the regular temp assignments. One of my best friends was also at the temp agency, and so we would fax each other notes since there wasn't an internet to do that with, and pass notes back and forth about what was going on and how funny it was to have this job. The guy who did the videos and took the videos was sort of an aspiring, you know, documentary filmmaker, and so he actually kept a blooper reel. the guys very much got in trouble and had to be edited for saying things about what they were looking for and saying inappropriate things, and women were more on the side of saying things about themselves that they shouldn't have said. Seeing how people presented themselves and the kinds of things they could do that shoot themselves in the foot taught me a lot about how to present myself, obviously in the dating world, but more specifically in the work world, the kinds of things you say about yourself and how that gets perceived. It was a good lesson.
Melissa O'Neill now works at an online media company. The stories in our series come from a book edited by Merritt Watts called First Jobs. This final note on the way out today, which A, I promise you I am not making up, but which also B, is kind of amazing. Today, the government declassified a whole bunch of documents it found in Osama bin Laden's compound in Pakistan. Lots of fascinating stuff there. We've got a link at marketplace.org. You should check it out. Among them, though, was a job application to join Al-Qaeda, which will sound familiar to anybody who has ever filled out any job application. What follows are all quotes from the actual document itself. Please write clearly and legibly. Have you ever been in jail or prison? List your previous occupations. And also these two. Do you wish to execute a suicide operation? And who should we contact in case you become a martyr? So many credits, so little time. Ravi Karman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Jake Gorski, Bill Lance, Garrett Lang, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Michael Raphael, and Charlton Thorpe engineer the program for us. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow. And oh yeah, once again, this is APM.